Well, good morning. I might have to go back here so I can keep an eye on Pastor here. Never see him over there. All right. Take it, everyone had a good week. Good morning, Messers. That was fun for you that went Tuesday to the National Night Out. That was a really good time. Thank you for all the work you did on that. And I have to admit, that's the first time I've been down to that. So that was nice. So anyways, hope everybody's well. We're on part two today, part two of What About the Angel? John chapter 5, if you want to turn to that, we will probably refer back to that. I'll just read it as you're looking. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there in Jerusalem by the sheep gate, a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people. That word sick, again, is without strength, impotent. Blind, lame, paralyzed. Or paralyzed means shriveled. Waiting for the moving of the water, for an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. And so we looked at that a little bit last time. And today I just want to look at that a little further. And I realize that we don't have the same customs and the same life that they did back then. But now versus then, I believe we have the same sin nature. And I'm going to look at this maybe a little different than others have looked at it, and I'll do a little bit of background. But we're talking about long-term infirmities here, long-term infirmities and treating long-term infirmities. Those are those things that have built up in us over time, and in this dispensation we speak of them as those spiritual and moral infirmities that we've had. Here we have a picture of a physical one. But there was different cultures then, but I believe sort of the same thing is happening now as it happened back then, the same sin nature. When it comes to anything, usually things start off good, but then slowly progress and get corrupted. And men look at opportunities, and there's really three things that drive those opportunities: money, power, and prestige. Those three things: money, power, and prestige. Last time we just looked a little bit about the current treating of infirmities. We saw that the addiction infirmities or maladies is a big business in this country. Just the addiction alone, the treatment of that, there's over 14,000 facilities we saw last time, bring in a total of $42 billion a year. In 2025, it's showing that it's supposed to bring in $53 billion, and it's just growing. That's just the addiction rehab in the United States. That doesn't include all the others. There's a lot of other disorders that treatment centers are popping up like popcorn all across this country. And it's become really a big business. It's a big business. There's a lot of money involved, a lot of power involved. I looked online and I looked at one of just anxiety disorder treatment. You know, there's a huge market in the anxiety disorder treatment market. It's a global market that brings in billions and billions of dollars, just that one. And I just want to read, this is a report that comes out every year to that industry. They call it an industry. And let's just listen carefully here and see if this industry really has their true heart into helping people, changing their hearts, changing their lives, or is it on business? Let's just look. The Anxiety Disorder Treatment Market Report comes out every year. This is the 2021. It says it unlocks new opportunities in the global business. The latest study highlights the key market trends significant to the growth prospect with specific players or list of players. You know how many people are in this business? I looked at a list and it's like this long, small letters of these corporations and so forth that are getting involved just in this one area, this anxiety disorder treatment. It also provides key players' market position, including the product price, the cost versus profit, capacity, production, capacity utilization, supply, demand, and industry growth rate. So we're talking all here business terms. How do we profit on this market? I read another one, and they're salivating over this COVID thing because the anxiety level from this is skyrocketing, and they're designing new inhalers, new drugs, new treatments for all of this. And the industry is really quite excited about this. And it says, additionally, the report also covers special sections. And these are all business terms. This doesn't have to do with the treatment terms. SWOT analysis, PESTEL analysis, break-even analysis, investment feasibility analysis, and investment return analysis. The report segments the global market and product based on type, technology, and end use. The growth among these segments will help the client, that's the companies involved in this, to analyze meager growth segments in the industries and provide the users with a valuable market overview and market insight to help them in making the strategic decision for identification of core market opportunities. It also highlights information regarding the current and former industry trends, growth pattern, as well as it offers well-known business tactics to the businesses and help the stakeholders in making sound decisions that may help to ensure the profit trajectory over the forecast years. So this is the treatment industry and business today. It's very, yes.
I would be very careful about singling out certain illnesses because your medical infirmities that you have, like you've got a couple stents in you.
Yes.
Those healthcare industries have the exact same parameters that you're speaking about.
I agree. And I want to get through this and I'll answer the questions at the end. But we're not talking about, and I made this plain before, about physiological things. We're talking about those spiritual behavior things, those moral things. And I wish I could give a whole class, and I don't know if I have time, on in this dispensation why we're not talking about physiological things. So we're not talking about those that have a physiological basis, but those that have a spiritual, those that come from the heart, those things that Jesus says makes you unclean, those things that come from the heart. Anxiety is, well, I really don't, because pretty soon, and I already talked to John about this, pretty soon it's difficult for him and everyone else. I'm just going to get through this and then we'll ask some questions. But this is just the anxiety order treatment market is what I was talking about, and then there's the addiction markets. Now, remember we're talking about Jesus alone to heal the heart. Jesus alone. Now, you would think with all this money, this billions and billions of dollars, all this education, all this professionalism, all this studies, that you would have an amazing success ratio. I mean, you would think with all this money spent and all the education and so forth that goes into this in this infirmity market, and we're talking about the heart issues, the spiritual issues, that this would have an absolute fantastic outcome. The product would be amazing. So I went and just looked at their material, not somebody's that's against this or anything. I just looked at their material and see how the cure ratio or the outcome, what is the outcome of these things? And there's an article here about how addiction treatment outcomes are measured. Now, I just want to look at this for just a little bit. While addiction may be known clinically as a substance use disorder, It says here it is actually a chronic disease. So they say it's a physiological thing. It's a disease, which is convenient. But this means it is similar to other chronic diseases like diabetes or hypertension. There is only treatments, not cures. They say there's not a cure for addiction. There's not a cure for this. It's only treatments. It says a disease like hypertension can easily be monitored through blood pressure tests. However, addiction affects the brain instead of physical processes, which is a sort of a smoky mirror thing here. If the brain, what is the brain if it's not a physical process, and what is it? But addiction affects the brain instead of physical processes, meaning that it is difficult to quantify improvements. Many times, monitoring addiction treatment means asking a patient how they feel and what they're thinking. So even to their own writings, they said there's no cure, there's just a treatment. I will absolutely go to the carpet and saying there is a cure, and it's Jesus alone. I'll get to that in a minute. But there are no universally accepted criteria for treatment effectiveness. So it could mean anything they want it to mean. They could say the treatment outcomes can be anything you want. So many rehab centers define success however they choose. Now, a person receiving effective addiction treatment should show some of the following. To me, success would mean, let's say if it's an alcoholic, I was an alcoholic, so I know. It'd mean you don't drink anymore. It would mean a cure would mean you don't even have a desire to anymore. But here is their criteria for measuring. A person receiving effective addiction treatment should show some of the following. The first one, I'll just reduced amount and frequency of substance use along with longer gaps between relapses. That's one of their measuring. So you should just, maybe there could be a reduction in how many times you drink. Well, how do you think that standard would go with this church? As I'm a deacon and all of a sudden on Saturday night you see me coming out of the bar. And you say, Mansky, what are you coming out of the bar for? And I'd say, well, I'm improving. I only go to the bar 3 times a night instead of 5 times a night. I mean, that standard would not hold here, and I hope it wouldn't. But that is, it's just a reduce, and it's improvement. Improved safety, such as fewer car accidents or injury. I just totaled 1 car this month rather than 2. I mean, you look at these outcomes. It says relapse does not mean failure. Relapse does not mean failure. If you relapse, what did Jesus tell this man? Sin no more. Sin no more, lest a worse sin come upon you. Relapse, it says, is an incredibly common part of recovery. And it's important to understand that returning to substance use does not mean treatment or recovery has failed. So relapse is an incredibly common part. Are they being healed? Relapse is also common in other chronic diseases, including diabetes and hypertension. Of course, they bring it back to physiological rather than a moral from the heart thing. Relapse does not mean failure. Instead, it means it is time to try a new treatment. More money, more, or adjust the current treatment approach. Success also depends on the length of treatment. Treatment of fewer than 90 days has limited effectiveness, while longer programming can have better long-term outcomes. The longer, the better. The longer, literally, the more money. You know how much money is spent on this. Here's just a couple of treatments. May include medical detox, residential inpatient treatment, outpatient treatment, aftercare. And then they talk about dual diagnosis. If you have this, you must have other things like anxiety and depression disorders and other things that we can help you with. Now, that is the outcome according to their own writings. Now, I told you before, I've had 4 major infirmity things that I've dealt with. One was alcoholism. I was an alcoholic even after I was saved. I knew it, like I told you, I knew it was wrong. I knew I shouldn't. I was convicted of it, but I kept doing it. I knew my wife hated it, and so forth. I already told you about my financial life back then, about 30 years ago. It was a train wreck, an absolute train wreck. Now, I was healed from those completely. From the drinking 30 years ago, I have not had a drop, not a relapse, nothing. I don't even have the desire for it. He took away the desire. In my finances, since that time, I've paid every bill I've had, other than small mortgages on homes that are worth a lot more than the mortgage. I haven't been in debt whatsoever. I pay all my bills. I was in the bank not too long ago, and Trudy looked up my credit rating, and she said it was the gold standard. I've even had extra money to help other people in need. Now, I don't take any credit for that myself whatsoever, or I don't take any credit for not drinking or having the desire to drink. I give it all to God. And you know how much it costs me? You know how much it costs me to be completely healed? Not just treated a little bit so there might be slight improvement, but completely healed. It costs me zero. Zero. I never went to treatment. I never went to a professional. I never went to a financial advisor. I went to God Himself. I got alone with God Himself and said, God, what do you want me to do? What does your word say you want me to do? You lay out a plan. Didn't cost me anything. It cost me everything, in a sense. It's all my rights were gone. I just said, God, it's on your terms. Jesus says, if you try to grab your life, you'll lose it. But if you let it go, you'll gain it. And I gained my life by losing everything, but I paid nothing. Nothing. Jesus alone is the only one that can reach in the heart and make those changes. I'm totally convinced of that. I will go to the carpet with that. I don't know if anyone here has gone to treatment. Now, I said before, if a treatment center points you to Christ, the one that can truly heal, I'm all for it. And there are some out there like that. But the average treatment center does not point you to Christ, and they have no ability to heal, but it's an opportunity to make money and an opportunity for power and money and the rest of it. And now let's go back to John chapter 5 here and look what I think is really going on. You might disagree with me today, that's fine. But I see a different story here. I see another opportunity. Why the strong tradition? We looked at that last time. Why is it so traditional? We saw that it was a scribal gloss in the margins for a while, and then it got finally in the text to try to explain the moving of the water. I believe there was some movement of the water. It could have been a spring. They said there looks like there was probably two pools maybe, and one was a reservoir and let in water, clean water, to this one that they were at. That could have been the movement of the water. There was some movement of the water here, and they saw this, and it was such a strong tradition that the tradition was an angel had come down at a certain time and moved the water, and the first that came in was healed. Now, we looked at last time. I don't think this was an angel from God. I don't want to go through all of it, but it wasn't prophesied that there would be an angel coming before the Lord to show his messianic signs or anything. Jesus never mentioned it. Angels, this wasn't usually their job, is to do things independently like this. And I didn't even get into the other part, but when you look at this, that whole theology here would not fit. This was sort of like the survival of the fittest in competition. When the pool is moved, whoever gets in first, who's ever the first one in, I mean, fighting, clawing all over each other to try to get in this, will be healed. Can you imagine Jesus healing like that? 10 lepers are, or whatever are in line, and says, okay, get ready, set, go. The first one to come and touch me will be healed. And they're clawing in competition. The whole thing here, there's something sketchy. There's something not right here. I don't believe this angel was from God, just so you know, at all. I think it was something else going on. Now, to try to get some background of what might be going on here, I just want to, first of all, this was done right outside the temple. We saw it was a feast of the Jews. We don't know exactly which one. I have my idea, but I'm not going to go into that. But it was one of the probably one of the big three feasts of the Jews, and it was right outside the temple. Now Herod the Great built this temple. Probably the biggest reason he wanted to be known as the greatest and prestige builder in the world. And he did everything to the extreme. This was extreme temple building. He magnified everything twice. I think the original Temple Mount was like, I believe, 17 acres. He made it 36. He expanded this thing huge. He made the temple proper itself with the Holy of Holies and so forth twice as big as Solomon's. Everything was twice as big, twice as great. And it actually took, and he wasn't around for the whole time, but it actually took 80 years to complete this thing. It wasn't even completed when Jesus came. In John it says this temple took 46 years to build. Actually, all of it wasn't completed until right before Titus came and sacked Jerusalem. It was probably only completed for about 2 years, complete, and all of a sudden, boom, God put the hammer down and it was gone. It was gone, torn down to bits and burnt. But this temple, we don't have time to go into all the intricacies of the temple, fascinating thing here, but the thing in our looking at it here, it was not handicap accessible, okay? It was not handicap accessible. This was it wasn't wheelchair handicap accessible at all. It was raised on this huge mount. Says the south wall, the south stairs, the main entrance to this temple, was a staircase 3 stories high. Can you imagine climbing that every time you came up just to the temple? Just to the plazas and all the porches and everything was 3 stories high of stairs you had to climb. Most other entrances, you had to go up stairs. This place was massive, and the crowds were massive. People that were blind and lame and shriveled and so forth, really, if you would have to do a lot of work to get them up to the temple. It was not handicap accessible. Herod was not interested in that. Herod was interested in his name. He was actually, I believe, half Jewish on one side of his family. He did have that. He did actually let them have their sacrifices through the entire building process. He actually had the Levites, they had to do most of the building because they're the only ones that could get inside the Holy Holies and build this thing. It's a fascinating story. But for our thing, it was massive and it was not accessible, easily accessible. It would have been very difficult. Now, that's just the little background of the temple. And now you got a couple high priests, Annas and Caiaphas. Annas, and almost all historians agree, he was a piece of work, this guy, I'll tell you. And I told Joe that this morning. I would say the best way to explain him would be a combination of 3 people. A corporate monopolist. He would be a Jeff Bezos. Political savvy, he'd be a Joe Biden, 78, what is he, 78? Almost 80-year-old guy, wins the presidency. And a crime syndicate, El Chapo. He'd be all 3 of these guys in one. Jeff Bezos, Joe Biden, and El Chapo. If you knew a guy that could be like that in one, this would be him. He had his fingers in everything. It's interesting, in about 6, I think, AD, around 6 AD, it's the Romans that appointed all these guys, the high priests. It was the Romans. This is the time of the Gentiles. So, you know, the Romans sort of oversaw everything, and then politically and because of the people, they appointed different people for this and that, but they appointed the high priest in those days, and they appointed Annas, high priest about 6 AD, and he was only technically the high priest for about, I think, 9 years. And the Romans, he was actually too harsh for the Romans. Believe that. They actually made him step down in the technical sense of it, because he was like the Taliban on steroids. He was people that made some Sabbath error or something. He used to have some of these people stoned. He used to kill people for religious infractions, and the Romans said this is too much. So they took him out, but he was so powerful and had so many connections to so many things that they appointed over time 5 of his sons, and Caiaphas here was his son-in-law, and after him his grandson got in. So he wasn't the high priest when Jesus came, but he was the high priest. He was the guy behind the curtain controlling all these things. That's why it says in Luke 3, I think, when it talks about John the Baptist, in the time of Annas and Caiaphas, the high priest, so there's really only one high priest, but Annas was the guy that controlled all the rest. It says when Jesus was taken at the Garden Gethsemane that they brought him to Annas first and then to Caiaphas. Then he sent him to Caiaphas. Annas had his hands in everything, in all the business. Now, he was a Sadducee, and the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in many things. They only believed in the first 5 books of the Bible. And so life consisted of here and now. And so he did whatever he could in the business. He literally had oversight of the entire temple area, actually Jerusalem proper. And it says during these feasts that these religious leaders were so powerful that they made an edict that they even had authority over the surrounding area around the walls of Jerusalem, including some of the small towns, which would include our pool here, by the way, which was just north of the temple, just outside the walls. So this guy had a monopoly over all the businesses. He was very political, and he was ruthless in making sure. That's why I remember Joseph Arimathea, he said he was a secret disciple. Why? Because of fear of the Jews. I mean, this guy put fear in these people. But they also saw him as the high priest. And when someone was appointed high priest, to the Jewish mind, that was for life. So even if Caiaphas and his sons were officially, by Roman edict, the high priest, they look for Annas. It's sort of, in a sense, a little bit like the Catholic Church and the Pope. The Catholic Church could fleece people blind, but they do whatever they say because of the Pope says this. My wife was a Catholic. She knows you have masses for the dead. You have all this money coming in, and they're fleecing you. But he was the high priest. I don't really have time to talk too much about the Pharisees, but the Pharisees came in a little later. They believed in the law, all the law and the prophets, and they were actually sort of the people's favorite in that sense. And so there was a sort of a twisted political thing between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Sometimes the Sadducees had to buckle the Pharisees because they didn't want to upset the people. It's sort of like the Democratic and Republican Party today, a lot like of the same. But so this is the high priesthood. I'm just going to read really quick, and then we'll see how this might affect what's going on here. This is MacArthur's commentary on when Jesus came in the temple, and I'll just read a little bit and then we'll discuss a little bit further. But as Jesus entered the temple, it was doubtlessly filled with thousands of Jewish worshipers milling about the outer court of the Gentiles, where everyone was allowed to enter. Perhaps the Jewish leaders reasoned that if Gentiles could be there, so could anything else. Within the past several decades, the area had come to be used as a religious marketplace. operated under the auspices of the high priest Annas. He was a corrupt and vile man who saw the temple and his exalted position only as means of personal power and wealth. His palace was, they've unearthed his palace. It was like crazy. The business enterprises in the court of the Gentiles came to be known as the Bazaar of Annas. I read another account that he had his people go up to the Mount of Olives during these festivals and set up businesses up there selling all kinds of oil and all kinds of stuff that people needed. That was known as the Bazaar of Annas, whose chief priests and other associates oversaw the temple franchises. Merchants would buy rights in a concession for selling sacrificial animals, wine, oil, or salt, or for the exchanging money into the proper currency and denominations used in the temple offerings. In addition to the franchise fees, the operators would often be required to pay a certain percentage of their profits to Annas. According to Levitical law, any animal approved by the priest could be offered in the temple, but the chief priest made certain that animals not bought in one of their franchises would be judged unacceptable, giving their concessionaires the de facto right to provide all animals. According to the Jewish Christian historian Alfred Erdensheim, a person would often have to pay as much as 10 times what an animal normally cost. As if that extortion were not enough, those who needed to have foreign currency exchanged or who had to have their money converted into the exact amount for an offering were charged a 25% fee. Jesus was therefore speaking quite literally when he called the temple marketplace a robber's den. So this is sort of the background. And what happens is before any of these feasts, there's three major feasts, but before any of these feasts, it's like when we collect money to go to the state fair, you know, you gotta have a wad of money, right, to go to the state fair. I remember even when I was young, you got to have at least $200 in your pocket. They saved up, actually, throughout the year for these festivals and for these feasts. And they saved up. And it was sort of like the state fair. There's lots of reasons for the state fair, but one of them is to see how much of that money you can get for yourself. And so these people came in with a lot of money, and they intended to spend it. And Annas made sure that they spent it, and he would get a cut almost everything that they spent. And so we see sort of that background of the high priest, and they even, the Pharisees started off good, by the way, but if you see Matthew 23, Jesus' this scathing report about who the Pharisees were, I believe Annas and the priesthood actually corrupted them also, and they were corrupt as well. And so we see that sort of background picture here, inaccessible temple. We also see that Annas had he looked constantly for opportunities to make money. Josephus says he was a hoarder of money. He was just a hoarder of money, just hoarded it, like someone would hoard stuff in their house. Anyone watch the show Hoarders ever? Once in a while I watch that, it's just like, oh. But this guy hoarded money, according to Josephus. That was his thing. Money, power, and prestige. Anyways, so here we have a situation. And I'm just going to look at a little bit, a few minutes we have. It was a very strategic location. People came in. It was on the east side of Jerusalem. A lot of times where some of these main roads came in from like Jericho and Bethany and so forth, they came in right up on the north side of the temple there. There was a gate there, actually this was right outside the city gates. There was the road that came right in there. And it was a very strategic location, this particular pool. And it says there that now in Jerusalem by the sheep gate was just on the north side of the Temple Mount, a pool which is called Bethesda, having five porches. And in these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, and so forth. These people come into town. You know, we gotta look at this in sort of a practical sense. These people can't live at the pool. Somehow, they're not going to slither to the pool from wherever they're at. I mean, they got to eat like us, they got to drink like us, they got to go to the bathroom like us. I mean, this is a great multitude of people at this particular pool. They don't live there. They got to get there someplace. And it makes total sense that when the people, you know, came from the surrounding areas and so forth to these feasts, that they had to drop their invalid relatives off someplace, either that or take them all the way up to the temple. When you look at this, and I've been involved in this because I used to drive for Metro Mobility and all those, this looks like to me just an adult daycare. This is something where you drop the people off, they stay there, everybody else goes up to the temple, and when they come back, they probably come and retrieve their relative or whatever. Because they just can't stay here. So it looks like an adult daycare would be a perfect strategic location for such a thing. It also had, I believe, a convenient operation. It had 5 porches, you know, shade here. It had this pool, and apparently fresh water was spring-fed, and then the pool reservoir ahead of it let water in once in a while. It's probably where the movement came in. It would have fresh water. It had shade, a perfect place to have an adult daycare. I used to take people all the time to adult daycare. That's just what I took them constantly, and because people had to go to work and so forth, and so you take them to a location. I believe, just a little side here, in the Church of God, there shouldn't, in a family church like we have here, there shouldn't be anybody, unless he's totally rebelling against God, that would be left out of coming to this church. I heard not too long ago there are some ministries set up to like take care of certain people, like maybe autistic kids or something, why their parents or whatever go to church. And I'm going, this should be the place that they should come to and they should go to. But they didn't go up to the temple. And one of the reasons I don't think any of them really went up to the temple, and I'll just say this really quickly, is that the first time Jesus went to the temple, he went to the temple itself. Remember, he overturned the tables and he talked to Nicodemus and so forth. He was in the temple, and he was like the new sheriff in town, and people were like, whoa, who is this guy? They knew who he was, because shortly after that, he went to Samaria, and then after Samaria, he went up again into Galilee, and it says here, so when he came to Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things he did in Jerusalem at the feast. So they knew who he was. They go, wow, this is the guy at the feast that overturned the tables. He had power and authority. But it says here that these people, the man that was healed, they asked him, who told you to take up your bed and so forth? And he says, I don't know who he was. They didn't know who he was. None of the people here cried out to him, oh, Lord, heal me. I don't think they knew who he was because I don't think they were ever up at the temple. I think they were dropped off here at this place. And it's interesting. I just put a little note here. The present employees, it says right when this guy was healed and took up his bed, it says the Jews said to him, who said you could do that? And I'm going, why are these Jews here? Now, these weren't just your Jewish citizens. These were Jewish leaders because they were very angry and they wanted to kill Jesus and they wanted to take care of him. Why were they not in the temple? Why were they outside literally the city gates at this pool with all these infirm people? They surely weren't there to help these people in, right? Because this guy said, no man, I have no man to help me. They weren't there to help people. I believe they were there to run an operation. Listen, Annas had he saw opportunities everywhere. This is just my thought. This is the theory. You can take it whatever you want. But I see the same thing happening today. They probably charge people, as they do today, to drop these people off at daycare. There's probably another business opportunity and arrangement that Annas had, and his people were there taking care of the adult daycare. That's how I see it. And the Jews were there. It's interesting because after the guy was healed, he went to the temple. And then it says when he returned, he told the Jews that it was Jesus that healed him. So again, those guys weren't up at the temple. They were here. And then I see this convincing show that they put on. I'm sorry, but I see this as a case, and this has been happening for history. It says, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another steps down before me. That word steps down literally means to descend on foot. They just walked right down. Now, I see here that all these people were either sick, and it doesn't mean they had a cold. That means without strength, impotent. That's what the word means. They were blind. They were paralyzed and shriveled. Now, how in the world can someone like that just walk down in the pool? That word to step down literally means to be ambulatory, to descend these stairs. Somehow they couldn't get up the stairs of the temple, but they could just walk right down into the pool. And all of a sudden get out and say, I'm healed. Can you imagine? You can say, oh, no one would plant someone there, would they? Would they do such a thing? I don't think sometimes we realize the depravity of these people. Yeah, they could. You know, the same thing happens today all the time. Once in a while, I love going to the religious channels. A couple weeks ago, I watched one. And this guy had a massive, massive group. And he was waxing eloquent and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, he'd walk up to somebody that was supposedly sick and put his hand on him and I'm healed. And he did that 3 or 4 times. And then the white buckets came out, literally white, big buckets with handles on them. All the ushers brought them out and put them each aisle in front of everybody. Now, everybody, come on up and you got to give to the Lord if you want blessings, you know, all this stuff. And people were just piling up. They literally brought buckets of money out of here, buckets of money. This planting isn't unusual. You go downtown, I'm down there all the time. There's people sitting in wheelchairs that are like this. They're not, there's nothing wrong with them. We've even seen people wheel a wheelchair up, sit down and put up a sign, give me money. It happens all the time. There's an interesting story about in 18-something, late 1800s, a ship had to go from Duluth to New, a port just a little bit away. And a big thing came up, and he'd sunk in the two harbors. It was the Ely, that was it. The two harbors, and they could just take the mast off. The rest of the ship was sunk. And in the 1950s, divers used to go in there and take all kinds of stuff like anchors and everything and put them in their yards. And so a company saw that as a great opportunity. And so they used to give tours, and they said, we'll give you a tour of this, the dive to the ship, and you can have a set of dishes from it when you find them. So the people went down, there's dishes there. Well, some reporter said, this is a little sketchy. And he went down and did a little undercover work, and what was happening is they were buying old dishes at Goodwill and thrift stores, and they were going in there before the dive and planting these dishes in there, and these people went down, and they were raking in all kinds of money. Because these people thought, I got dishes from the Ely out of two harbors. They were so excited. Well, as soon as he blew that wide open, their business died. But then here comes Jesus. All right, I believe this was a plant. An ambulatory person walked in, I'm healed, and it just drew people there, and people said, I'm going to drop my relative off there. He might be able to get healed. Then we see the disruption of Jesus. Here comes Jesus, and he actually heals somebody. And they were indignant. You always think, oh, you said, you know, you told them to do this on the Sabbath. I don't think they had any desire to honor God. I think they were mad because if he can come and actually heal people, we're going to lose this business. And the disruption of Jesus, and we see that he has it out with them the rest of chapter 5. He says, basically, if you think this is great, I can heal, I will raise people from the dead. And he talks about the resurrection and all this kind of stuff. But I just want you to turn really quick, and we're almost done here. Matthew chapter 21. This is 3 years later. 3 years later. And I believe people saw the sham that this was. And I see that they saw the real healer. And guess who we see up in the temple now? In Matthew 21, this is 3 years later. This is his last trip to the temple before the Passover and before his crucifixion. In 21, verse 12, then Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. Now, at his first thing, he said, don't make this a house of merchandise, basically saying it was a corporate monopoly, but now he calls it a den of thieves, a crime syndicate. And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. Then guess who's there? Then the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. Now, the blind and the thing aren't at the pool of Bethesda. They know who is the healer, Jesus alone. And now people are dragging them. They're getting these people up these stairs, and they're bringing them to the temple because it's Jesus who heals, and it's Jesus who is healing them now. And it says in verse 15, but when the chief priests and scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, at the end it says they were indignant. They were indignant. I believe they were indignant because he was destroying their businesses. He was destroying their power. Pilate got it right. He's got street smarts. He said he knew why they turned him in. It was from envy. So real quick, we don't have time to get unveiling their true character. Read Matthew 23 if you want to know what Jesus' idea of these people are. You know, it's Jesus alone. If $42 billion and so forth can't heal, if all these people have all these educational certificates on and they can't heal, how do you think you're going to heal yourself when you have some infirmity that's been taking over your life? Go to Jesus alone. Get together with him alone. Just you and him, and ask him, God, I want to be made well. Show me how. It is Jesus alone. None of this other stuff, unless they, like I said, they point you to Jesus. It's Jesus alone. And we better quit. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word, and we just pray that that Father, we would come to you. You alone can heal. You alone can reach into the heart. And even when we have physiological problems and difficulties, Father, we can show your grace and your power to live a life according to Christ and be like that pearl of great price, Father, that pearl that shows forth its beauty when it surrounds irritations and corruption. And Father, that we might be your people, that we might come to you, be healed by you alone. And we just thank you for this promise. In Jesus' name, amen.